Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and a very interesting and different subject on today's podcast. You know, I get a slew of books, and, you know, frankly, the books kind of pile up on my desk, and, you know, some of them are just not a fit. But here's a book we're about to talk about that I took a look at, and I absolutely became engrossed with this book. The book is entitled Strange Medicine: A Shocking History of Real Medical Practices Through the Ages. And this book is not just a compendium of medical anomalies and horrible practices that have long since been abandoned. It's also a very interesting reflection on the progress of medicine, and it provides us with a little bit of a perspective on some of the things that we may be doing now that are tried and true medical procedures that many centuries hence, looking back from the vantage point of someone in the year 2400, we might consider quite barbaric, because such is the history of medicine. The author of Strange Medicine is with us. He is Nathan Bolovsky. Nathan is a medical journalist. He is a journalist. He's recently turned his sights on medicine. He's the author of The Book of Strange and Curious Legal Oddities, which is kind of a companion edition to Strange Medicine. And he is with us today for the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. So welcome, and tell us how you got involved in this project, Strange Medicine.
Thank you for having me. I've always been interested in history and particularly science, and I began looking into medicine, and a certain proposition intrigued me that for maybe 2,000 years or so, since, say, the ancient Greeks, arguably medicine actually got worse instead of better until relatively recently. And that idea intrigued me, and I started exploring it, and I wrote this book. And I think maybe if you read the book, you'll find that that it's it may well be true that.
Well, that's interesting, because, you know, we tend to think of history as, you know, like a slow, steady progress, you know, by scientific discovery, trial and error, and especially when it comes to medicine. I mean, things were very primitive. You know, people used to think it was the gods, the stars that guided everything, and then, you know, gradually they accumulated a knowledge base. But in this book, as you so well point out, the classic era. Greece and Rome, they were on the ball about certain things. And then it was almost as if we regressed and went into kind of a dark ages, which is actually what it was called. And there were some pretty weird things that were done during those days.
Yeah, medicine did go into the dark ages. The problem was that other things went into the dark ages too, but medicine never came out of it until relatively recently.
Uh-huh.
Arguably,
and some people would say that there's still some elements of the Dark Ages in modern medicine.
Oh, sure, and I'm sure people in a few hundred years will look back at us and think we're in the Dark Ages. But medicine seems to be unique among the arts and sciences in that it got worse instead of better over the centuries and millennia, actually.
Well, let's start with ancient Greece. And Rome, you know, where we had all these great medical thinkers. You know, we often quote Hippocrates, at first do no harm, and we had a lot of these great medical thinkers. You know, what did they get right about medicine? What are some of the things they were able to do, and what did they discern that was correct?
Boy, I'm a big admirer of Hippocrates. Hippocrates essentially was the person who turned the corner from magic to medicine. In his day, when someone got sick, basically, you would appeal to the gods.
Like a shaman, you know, you'd have like a witch doctor.
Absolutely. And, you know, you would pray and you would chant, or you would have someone do it for you, and oftentimes they'd be very well paid to do that. Hippocrates said, no, illness and sickness is a natural phenomenon. It's like the wind and the tides. And we can treat it. We can't always fix it, but we're certainly going to try. And he was a very practical, hands-on sort of person.
And but on the other hand, you know, while they had some very, very strange notions, and you'll share some of those with us, they did have some degree of skill in addressing some of the common ailments that we see, you know, in the 21st century. Like if you broke a bone, they had bone setters. If you were wounded in battle and pierced by an arrow, they had people who knew how to pull it out and maybe sew it up. They even had, you know, if you had somebody bash you on the head, you know, with a rock or a club, they actually knew how to evacuate the blood clot, you know, sometimes do what would be considered delicate neurosurgery and, you know, literally leave you with a hole in your head that was healed.
Absolutely. That's trepanation. And my book actually starts with the Babylonians. And, of course, Babylonian medicine was very primitive. But they were sometimes ingenious. They could certainly heal wounds and fix bones. And the Egyptians had some amazing remedies, not all of them. And I point out some of the stranger ones. But one example that sort of shocked me is that they did cataract surgery.
Whoa.
And I've been told by a rather prominent medical historian that it actually worked. They would pour molten glass into a person's eye. And somehow I was told that that worked.
Huh.
They were quite ingenious back then.
Yeah, as unappetizing as that may sound, they got results. What are some of the more bizarre things that you know used to happen to people 2,000 years ago or 3,000 years ago?
Well, I'm thinking of the ancient Egyptians again. For gout, they would try to treat people by applying electric eels. They would either wrap them around their heads or their patients' heads or have them stand on electric eels. And the ancient Greeks did the same thing. Hippocrates himself writes about the application of electric eels for migraine headaches. The ancient
Greeks... It
sounds
a little bit like modern electroshock therapy, which...
It has a certain kinship to that. Yeah, and the concept is the same. They just didn't have batteries or anything to plug in.
Right.
Going back to the ancient Greeks, Hippocrates talks about throwing hunchbacks off of tall buildings to cure their backs, to straighten out their backs. They would tie them to a ladder and then drop the ladder off the tallest building they could find.
If your watch doesn't work, you know, hit your watch with a hammer and it might...
Absolutely. And Hippocrates was very critical of that particular medical procedure.
This is one of the controversies in medicine of the day. There are people saying, you know, drop the hunchback over the cliff, and Hippocrates is saying, no, that's not scientific. No, we should get over the primitive barbarism of dropping people off of cliffs and not do that anymore.
Absolutely. In fact, he called the practitioners of that stupid. That was the word he used.
Okay.
He said, they're stupid.
Okay. And I think history was with him on that. So a lot of this was based on sort of random acts, you know, sometimes extreme acts to propitiate the gods or to do something bizarre. They also had this theory of the humors of the body. How did that work out?
Yeah, that's something that Hippocrates and the ancient Greeks got wrong. The ancient Greeks believed that the body had four humors. The four humors were blood, black bile, yellow bile, and phlegm. And they thought that sickness was caused by an imbalance of these humors. So if you got sick, they would try to basically evacuate the body of one of these humors, thus bloodletting and that sort of thing.
And enemas to get it out.
Oh, absolutely, yep. Absolutely. Enemas, vomiting, anything that could get the fluids out of the body.
Mm-hmm.
And that theory actually held sway until, 1700s, 1800s, when doctors were doing bloodletting more than ever to evacuate the bad humors.
Yeah, we'll get to that in just a moment. But so what ended up happening is, of course, in the Middle Ages or the Dark Ages, people would live in an environment where they would see ancient Roman ruins and they would dream of civilizations that preceded them, but they were living under more primitive feudal circumstances. They were serfs working in fields, there were knights running around, and there were all kinds of wars, plagues, But it was almost as if civilization took a step backwards, and certainly medicine did during the so-called Dark Ages.
Medicine absolutely did, and it's funny because it took a step backwards in sort of an ironic way. I always thought of medieval medicine as being quite ignorant, no books, no education, but in fact it was just the opposite. Medieval doctors went to school for years and years, and that was the problem. They became pompous and overeducated. They became more like philosophers than actual physicians. In fact, it got to the point where they disdained actually touching their patients. They would leave that to the surgeons and the barber surgeons, who they would look down on.
Actually, there's almost kind of a bifurcation between internal medicine and surgery. And the surgeons weren't even really highly trained doctors. They just were the people who had the sharp instruments.
That's right. And I found the surgeons rather heroic during the Middle Ages and after that. They weren't as highly educated, but they were really the people who were actually going in there and taking care of people. The physicians, especially the more prestigious ones, they'd walk around in their purple robes, and they made a lot of money. And they would just talk. They would double talk people. They would see a patient, and they would stand there for half an hour double talking the patient using all these big words.
Well, this may be why in literature, and if we look at the history, doctors were not held in such high repute. A lot of people, thought that the key to health was to stay away from doctors.
Absolutely. Yes. And I would say from medieval times on, until a thousand years later, doctors did more harm than good, and that was commemorated by many novelists and writers.
Right. I mean, you could even see it in the writings of Shakespeare, that he doesn't have, he reserves some criticism for quacky doctors.
It was quite deserved. Quacks and legitimate, or members of the establishment, too, who would just absolutely do nothing. They would pretend to treat people, but they really didn't.
Okay, so it wasn't if you don't know anything, don't just stand there, do something. But the something was sometimes pretty bizarre. What were some of the really most crazy medical practices of the Middle Ages?
Let's see. One of my favorites was elf sickness, where in the Middle Ages, doctors thought that some illnesses were caused by tiny, invisible little elves shooting invisible little arrows at people. And they had all sorts of cures for that. One of the most horrifying treatments in the Middle Ages was the hot iron, the cautery.
Oof.
And basically it was like a branding iron. And they would apply it to people all over their body, say 10, 12 times in some sort of pattern, say a couple on the forehead, a couple on the chest.
Almost like acupuncture. It was like acupuncture, but with hot branding iron.
Yes, except with a branding iron.
Okay.
And they would go right down to the bone.
Ooh.
And that was thought to be the cure for everything from epilepsy to depression to bad skin.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, this was the time when they had the terrible plagues, that decimated the population of Europe. So what were some of the more outlandish things that were done when the plagues came around?
There's a chapter about medical astrology, and this really isn't a treatment. It's more a philosophy, but I thought it was the most outrageous thing of all. Medieval physicians believed that the plague was caused by the positions of the stars and the planets. And for that reason, essentially, they felt that really there wasn't much they could do about it, since, this was preordained. They had all sorts of strange treatment in the Middle Ages and then into the Renaissance. They would walk around in these strange costumes. They would be called beak doctors. They would wear these sort of gas masks with huge beaks that were a foot and a half long sometimes. And in that beak they would have some sort of mesh or screen that would supposedly screen out the bad humors floating around in the air. And there were all sorts of outrageous other outrageous treatments. Mercury was used against just about everything. Applying it to people, having them swallow it. The compendium of medieval treatments is just amazing.
Right, and that's just detailed to an almost excruciating fashion in the book. And so one of the problems is that during the Middle Ages, it was absolutely forbidden to desecrate bodies, so that doctors really had virtually no idea what they were working on. They had like major misconceptions about even where the internal organs lay in the body, and you know, anatomy wasn't developed until the Renaissance.
That's right. For all sorts of reasons, cultural and religious, doctors certainly weren't allowed to open up people's bodies. You know, maybe if they got lucky, they could find a person who was still alive, who was grievously wounded, and you know, they could sort of look into a person's body. But they really did no anatomy at all. In fact, they relied on the anatomy done by a gentleman named Galen, and he was in Roman times, a few hundred years after Hippocrates. And Galen was the greatest anatomist until the Renaissance. But even Galen, he wasn't allowed to open up bodies either, so he could only he did most of his work on pigs. And pigs are sort of similar to people in some ways, but they're sort of different too.
Yeah, and I think he had some idea that there were the fluids flowed through the body, kind of like the tides flowed through the oceans, you know, back and forth was an ebb and flow. But he had no concept of the circulatory system. That is until Sir William Harvey actually documented the blood vessels and the heart and, you know, came up with the idea that the heart pumps blood out and the veins bring the blood back.
That's right. Galen's anatomy was brilliant as far as it went, but, you know, it was very primitive. But his anatomy prevailed for until the Renaissance.
It took 1,500 years. I mean, I think what that's an example of is just, you know, tradition. And even in the face of abysmal results, medicine kept hewing to these ancient traditions that really weren't very effective.
That's right. They just kept, they just went back to Hippocrates and Galen. And, you know, Hippocrates and Galen were brilliant doctors, but they became almost religious figures in a sort of perverse way, where doctors said, oh, we don't want to learn anything more than Galen and Hippocrates have taught us. And that's something Galen and Hippocrates would never have said in their time. They would never have said, no, we've learned everything. You don't have to do any more learning. So the philosophy of medicine became twisted and perverted, and it went nowhere.
Now, of course, during this entire time, until very recent times, until the 1800s, there was virtually no anesthesia, right? And so all these surgeries, and sometimes they did pretty invasive surgeries, all this was done restraining the patient, tying him down, you know, having like four assistants grab a limb, and this was done, you know, causing excruciating pain.
That's right. It was done that way in the Middle Ages and through the Renaissance and up through 1840s, 1850s, essentially. And I have descriptions of the surgeries. I try to stay away from the gruesome, but I do describe how people, oftentimes the assistants themselves would faint, sometimes the surgeons.
The surgeons would faint.
Yes. And I describe back then in the 1800s, a really top-notch surgeon could do an amputation in between 30 and 90 seconds. And once in a while, he would accidentally, you know, cut off the fingers of his assistants because of that speed.
Yeah, I mean, because that was where it was at, because you had to, you know, on a battlefield or something like that. Even, you know, this is even the case during the Civil War. They would, you know, the solution for gunshot wounds was, you know, immediately lop off the involved limb because it was certain to get infected and there was no way to prevent that. So there would be heaps of, you know, hands, feet, you know, arms. You know, in battlefield hospitals that were filthy, and that was what combat medicine was like in the Middle Ages.
That's right. In the 1800s, I have an account of one of London's most famous doctors, and he would do his surgeries in front of his medical students, and he would make his medical students bring stopwatches, and he would say, time me,
wow,
to drive home the importance of speed, so
right.
to avoid shock and infection.
Absolutely. All right. So now, you know, you made a very interesting point, which is you said, okay, so finally we emerged from the Dark Ages, and you'd think by now there's scientific progress, there's the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution, but in medicine it didn't really happen. They entered the era of what was called heroic medicine. So describe that for us.
Yeah. Heroic medicine, it wasn't that the doctors were being brave. It was that they were so frustrated at seeing their patients just get sick and die without them being able to do anything about it, that they decided to take things into their own hands, and they became very aggressive and activist, and I would say desperate or even reckless. And that's what heroic medicine was. It wasn't the doctors being brave. It was them taking extraordinary measures. The problem was there was no real philosophy or even common sense behind a lot of the things they did. It was almost like they just got so frustrated they wanted to do something, anything. They just wanted to keep busy.
Well, maybe there was an element of hubris there. They thought, okay, you know, if we can simply, you know, eradicate the pathogens, drive them out of the body, you know, we just have been too passive. Let's, you know, with all this new science at our disposal, let's really attack disease.
You're right. You know, I mentioned frustration, but yes, there was a good deal of hubris as well. Many of the leading doctors, they were very confident and cocky, and they would just sort of dream up these new procedures with no sound foundation behind them, and then they would just go ahead and do it. And then afterwards, they wouldn't even check to see what the results were. They would just keep doing it.
And so there wasn't any, like, self-evaluation?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
So this was the era, you know, there's the world's leading medical journal is called The Lancet, and I don't think that many people know the origination of that term. The Lancet refers to a lancet that's used for cutting, and the cutting was mainly done so that we could bleed patients, because bleeding was one of the flagship therapies of the day.
Yeah, before I started writing this book, I always associated bleeding with the Middle Ages. And then when I was researching this book, I found that bloodletting reached its peak during the 1800s.
Well, George Washington was bled when he was dying. It was thought that he had...
That's right. He's a great example. He became sick, and in 10 hours he was seen by three of the best doctors in the whole country, and between the three of them, they drained him of, I think it was about 120 ounces of blood. That's 6 or 7 pints of
uh-huh.
blood.
Yeah.
And he died.
Hastened his demise. Yeah.
It appears that way. It certainly didn't help him, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very typical of doctors of the heroic era.
What was the rationale for bleeding patients in those days?
The rationale was to, believe it or not, to get the bad humors out of the body.
So still going back
to the
Galen.
Ancient Greeks.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
That was about as good a reason as they had.
Purging, getting. And then, of course, there was another method of eliminating the bad blood, and that was by using leeches.
Yes, leeches, they had sharp little teeth, and in the book, I always thought, okay, the doctors would apply leeches to the arms of the patient or maybe their torso, and that was sort of disgusting enough, but in researching it, I learned that oftentimes they would be applied into bodily cavities. They would be dangled down the throat. Doctors would tie silk string or maybe some sort of fishing line to a leech, and then let it down the throat, and then they'd let the leech do its work in the person's stomach, and then they'd reel it back in like a fish.
Hmm.
And then I don't want to get too explicit, but they would put leeches in other bodily cavities as well. In fact, I found a number of journal articles which describe the problem of what happens, particularly in women, when the line breaks and a leech gets lost inside her body. And according to the doctors, women, these high-strung women, as they said, would become hysterical, and that's the word they used.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the doctor's job to calm down these crazy women, and they would reassure them, don't worry, the leech will come out in a few days.
Hmm. Knowing full well that that might not be the case.
No, and I don't even want to, that's something I don't even want to think
about.
We
don't even want to go there. So, but yeah. This is actually an important concept in medicine, and I think it's really part of, one of the pillars of sexism and male domination that was so characteristic of our society, is that many women were branded as having a condition called hysteria. Now, we know that hysteria, I think it comes from the Greek for womb or uterus. And so what is hysteria, and what were some of the more far-out treatments for hysteria?
Yeah, hysteria sort of threads its way through the whole book, and it begins with the ancient Greeks and the wandering womb. The ancient Greeks believed that in some women, especially women who are single or who are starved for affection, the frustrated womb would often wander up from the belly up towards the woman's head. That was the wandering womb.
I don't know. Maybe this is like a precursor of Sigmund Freud for sexual repression.
It may well be, and they made about equal sense, I would
right.
say.
In other words, Sigmund Freud thought of it as being figurative. They, in ancient medicine, they thought that literally the womb migrated into the brain.
Absolutely. And Hippocrates' solution, and again, I'm a big admirer of Hippocrates, but this is one that he got wrong, was he thought wandering wombs were very sensitive to smell.
Mm-hmm.
And so what he would do is he would make the patient smell something really terrible, say burnt hair. And that terrible smell would supposedly drive the wandering womb back from the head back to the belly where it belonged.
Hmm. Okay. It certainly made the patient pretty miserable, maybe shut her up for a while.
It did. Women did not have it easy during the Greek times or during the Middle Ages or during the Renaissance, especially at the hands of doctors.
Mm-hmm. So, clearly hysteria, a frequent diagnosis. And your book shows that medicine was replete with sexual misinformation, information about, sexual habits and libido and so on. What are some of the more egregious examples of that?
Absolutely. I think a lot of people have heard of these really drastic remedies for masturbation, and I include those in the book, but there's also a chapter about.
In other words, this is thought to be an affliction. If you were someone who masturbated, which now in the year of Masters and Johnson, we recognize the prevalence of that. But in the past, it was thought this was a mortal sin or some kind of deviant behavior, and there were actually medical treatments applied to this. And what are some of the more outlandish treatments?
For masturbation, applying acid to the private parts, locking a person's private parts in a little cage where someone else would be given the key.
Okay.
Then there were all sorts of beds with spikes on them that would, where if a person moved too much on the bed, the spikes would penetrate. For women, there were shaving the clitoris.
This is what they're talking about, female circumcision, which is there's a big campaign to curtail that in parts of Africa where that's still done. But this you're saying that this procedure was done throughout the world in the Middle Ages.
in the Middle Ages, but also in the 1800s.
Goodness gracious.
Of America and Europe's leading doctors. In fact, Dr. Harvey Kellogg, the inventor of the cornflake, he advocated for women pouring carbolic acid on their
flesh. So these doctors would get together in lecture halls, you know, wearing tailcoats and top hats and, you know, the little sort of frou-frou ties that they wore in those days. And they would have intellectual discussions about how best to suppress the dangerous female impulses.
Absolutely. And I should point out, one of the criteria for my book is that I don't have a single quack in my book. I specifically limited it to establishment doctors, prominent doctors, doctors who were the leading doctors of their day. So when you say they were in black tie and tails, yes, you hit it right on the head, and then they would write about their exploits
in medical journals.
In medical journals, like the New England Journal of Medicine, or its equivalent in England, the Lancet, and tens of thousands of other doctors who were really thirsting for knowledge. They would read this, and they would do the same.
And they would nod, you know, approvingly, and say, "Well, you know, this is innovative new treatment that they're doing there in America. Maybe that's something we should try on our patients here."
Yes, by the best and the most respected doctors. Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
Wow. Moving ahead into your more recent history, the popularity of electrical therapies. That, you know, once electricity started to become popular in the 1800s, people were just blown away by its magical properties, and it was applied in a very rampant way in medicine, sometimes in bizarre ways. What are some of those?
Yes, you can imagine how appealing electricity was to doctors at that time. It was new, it was exciting, it was mysterious, and when they found out that, you know, the body actually created its own electricity, that just really set them off. Oh, there were electric cures for really anything. If you were blind, they would apply electricity. If you were lame, they would apply electricity. It could do just about anything. You know, of course, for masturbation, you can imagine the, you know, the cures.
You could have an electrical chastity belt, you know.
there were worse than that. There were electrical, you know, instruments to apply electrical shocks, where the doctor would apply electrical shocks to the person. And then there was a further development where they actually developed some sort of device where a person himself, in the privacy of his own home, could shock himself. That was considered a great medical advance.
Mm-hmm. In other words, to forestall the temptation.
Yes, right.
Okay. So, you know, we move along into the 20th century, and one of the 20th century vogues, you know, similar to the vogue for electrical therapies, was X-rays and radiation therapies. You know, towards the end of the book, you comment on that.
Yes, I talk about the fluoroscope. You know, obviously the X-ray machine, you know, discovered by Rentgen, was a huge, you know, step forward. But what happened was, doctors, among others, began thinking of all these creative uses for X-rays, and one of them that became most established was for fitting shoes. They created these very large machines that were installed in shoe stores. They were the size of...
Yeah, some of our older listeners might actually remember going to the shoe store with their parents and getting this done.
Yes, they were called footoscopes, and they were the size of, say, a small desk, and children especially loved them. What a child would do is the child would stick his foot into a slot in the bottom of the machine, and then the shoe salesman would turn on the X-ray. And from the X-ray, they could, you know, supposedly determine the precise best way to fit someone's shoe. And of course, you know, the more X-rays you took of the child, well, maybe the better the fit would be. And it was fun, you know, pressing the button. So the whole family would join in, you know, pressing that.
Like a modern marvel.
That's right. And so, you know, more and more x-rays of the child. And no studies were done of how many people died from, you know, exposure to too many x-rays, not to mention the shoe salesmen themselves. You know, these things tended to leak radiation all over the shoe store. And these were created by doctors. The doctors held the patents to these machines.
Okay, so now we take us up into the 20th century. We're now in the year 1939, and surely scientific progress has banished some of these bizarre practices, and, you know, we're entering an era of rational medicine. But one of the more bizarre practices in your book was introduced by a Portuguese doctor, Dr. Egas Moniz. Tell us about that one.
That's right. Dr. Moniz, who was nominated for a Nobel Prize, he decided that by scraping away a person's brain tissue, that could alleviate mental illness. There was no real theory behind that, but what Dr. Moniz began doing is he began drilling holes in people's skulls and shoving instruments into the holes and destroying brain cells.
He would literally like get people together in one of those operating theaters, and he would stand there with the ice pick in hand and a mallet, and he would demonstrate the precise technique for obliterating part of the brain by driving a spike through the eye.
Actually, you're talking about the next development, supposedly an advance on Dr. Muniz. This is Dr. Walter Freeman. Dr. Walter Freeman, a graduate of Yale. He wasn't a trained surgeon, and he wasn't really into anesthesia or a sterile field. And he thought things took way too long, you know, having to go through the skull. So he devised a procedure. He practiced in his kitchen on a grapefruit, and he used an ice pick from the kitchen drawer. He decided it was much faster if you just shoved an ice pick through a person's eyes. And through the eye socket, correct.
So in fairness, he left the visual system intact. I mean, if it survived the operation.
Yes, that's right. You are being fair to him. he would take, at first he began using an ice pick, and then he graduated to a different instrument, but it was essentially an ice pick. And he would shove that into the person's eye, and then he would hit the bone of the skull, and then he would take a carpenter's mallet, and he would bang away to penetrate the skull. And then when he hit the brain, he would sort of go in a back and forth motion, like a windshield wiper.
Gouge a little bit back and forth.
That's right. And that procedure might take 30 seconds. And he was very proud that he was ambidextrous. So at a certain point, he could actually do both eyes at once. And he was very proud of that.
He took sort of a showman-like glee in demonstrating this to medical students and other doctors.
That's right. He loved to demonstrate in front of other doctors, in front of journalists. There's many photographs of him doing it. You can see a photograph on my website, strangemedicine.com. Yes, he was quite a showman, and he had a certain charisma, and he became the world's leading brain surgeon for a matter of decades. The problem was, and Dr. Freeman knew it himself, he would do these surgeries, and the people would emerge from these surgeries, and maybe they wouldn't appear quite as mentally ill as they had before. They wouldn't be quite as troublesome to their families, shall we say, but they would seem almost like they had lost their souls. They would have almost like zombies. And Dr. Freeman noted this very carefully in his medical records because he was very methodical, but he thought it was very worthwhile. And a lot of the families cheered him on because it meant that their brother or sister or son or daughter were much easier to take care of. And these lobotomies, Dr. Freeman did over 2,000 of them himself. He could do a lot. They would only take maybe a minute or so. And they spread all over the world.
Hey, there's actually the celebrated case of John F. Kennedy's sisters who Rose Kennedy suffering from some unknown mental disorder, and she underwent the procedure. And this was, you know, one of the most prestigious, wealthy families in America, thinking they were availing themselves of top-notch medicine.
That's right. And Dr. Freeman became a hero for decades, and he would go around. He had a station wagon. He called it the lobotomobile, and he would go around with his family and his kids, and he'd take his family, his kids, and his dog, and his medical instruments, and he'd stuff them into the station wagon. And he loved going to the national parks with his family. But on the way to the national parks, he'd stop off at local hospitals. He was treated like a visiting hero.
Right, right.
And he would do 2, 3, 4 of these on any mentally ill patients that they could round up.
Mm. Wow. And this was presumably the 1950s, correct?
That's correct, yes.
Wow. Okay, so, you know, we hear all these medical horrors and things that we look back on and we say, well, this was really barbarous. But if we do so, do we not fall prey to something which I think is a very interesting concept, which is the concept of presentism? You know, we talk about chauvinism, which is like, you know, you believe that your country is the best country in the world to, you know, the exclusion of others. Or we talk about racism, you know, you think that your race is better than others. But in presentism, we believe that we have reached the pinnacle of scientific understanding in present time, and we have a sense that everybody who was our predecessor was stupid, ignorant, and thank goodness that era is gone by, and we've now emerged into an era of enlightenment. Is this book a cautionary tale that we might many years hence look back on some of our procedures in medicine and say, gee, how is it that they ever thought that was the right way to go?
This book is a cautionary tale. And, you know, this book, maybe it has a certain exasperated tone, but it's more towards the institution of medicine itself than the doctors. And this shows how a field that's probably the most important field of all, you know, more important than, say, astronomy or transportation, can just go off the rails for 2,000 years, and no one says anything, and no one does anything about it. So I think it is a cautionary tale that we have to be careful, that even, you know, even the leaders of medicine today, we have to be very careful and use some common sense, because that certainly wasn't something in abundance for over 2,000 years from the time of the ancient Greeks until relatively recently.
So I think the take-home message is be humble, avoid hubris, avoid overconfidence in our current medical modalities, and always be self-critical. Always look to make progress, and don't be afraid to upset the apple cart and look for alternative paradigms to better cope with the illnesses that we see people suffering from.
Yeah, that's a great summary. I wish I had written that in the book. Yes, be humble and look around and think. Try to think of new ideas and don't rest on your laurels because there's always something better out there.
Okay, so the book is Strange Medicine, A Shocking History of Real Medical Practices Through the Ages. It's a real fast read. You'll be engrossed. Probably finish it in a weekend. The author, Nathan Belovsky. And if you want to learn more, there's a great website. You put together a website called strangemedicine.com. They've got pictures and descriptions and samples of some of the bizarre practices that you detail in the book. Congratulations. Great job.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
My pleasure. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.